You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of the 2008 ICAC IDSA Joint Conference. The conference took place in Washington, D.C. from October 25th through October 28th, 2008.
This is David Wohl from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And what I'd like to do today is discuss HIV therapeutics at ICAC and IDSA with a highlight of clinically relevant take-homes. There were a number of different studies presented at this combined conference. And I think that it's always a challenge to try to sift through the data and bring back those lessons that we should learn and apply to our clinical practice. For most of us, our progress is made a step at a time, and the paving stones for our advancing our understanding of HIV therapeutics really comes in the form of clinical trials. And there were a variety of clinical trials presented, including head-to-head trials. And it's interesting that this is playing out at the same time that the World Series is playing out, not to mention campaigns for public office. And the idea is the same, that we're attempting to compare, ideally on a level playing field, two or more contenders for our loyalty. And so here we see a number of head-to-head trials that are being presented and trying to tell us what they think may be the best way for us to treat HIV. In our field and in medicine in general, cutting-edge physicians have no choice but to pray at the altar of the randomized controlled trial. We depend upon randomization to level that playing field so that we can look at these different therapies closely and understand their advantages and disadvantages. Those are the ones that catch my attention, the ones I'll be discussing. They generally fall into three categories, and it's sort of hackneyed, but it's something old, something new, and something basically done over. So I'll talk about the something new category of randomized clinical trials, and really one really made the most impression, and that was the SMARTMARK study, and this is a study of raltegravir. Raltegravir is a new drug, and the class is integrase inhibitors. Over the past year, we've become increasingly comfortable mixing this drug together with others in order to create regimens for people who are heavily treatment experienced. Some of us clearly have been seduced into using this drug as part of a second-line regimen. It's ritonavir-free and has a minimal pill burden, so it's easy to see why that could be a handy drug in this circumstance. But there really have been few data to bolster those of us who are itching to use the drug as a first-line therapy. Marty Markowitz has presented data from a relatively small dose-ranging study in which raltegravir was compared to efavirenz. And these results were reassuring in that there were no glaring differences between these drugs seen out to even 96 weeks. At this conference, what we saw was Jeff Lennox from Atlanta present the first large, well-powered study of raltegravir for initial therapy of HIV. The SMARTMARK trial was double-blind, and it compared raltegravir BID to efavirenz in treatment-naive patients who are also receiving the fixed-dose combination of tenofovir and FTC. And like most of its ilk, this trial was a non-inferiority study, and the outer bounds of the confidence interval for non-inferiority was set to be 12%. Thus, if your 95% confidence interval exceeded that, you would then not be able to say you were not inferior to the comparator. The primary endpoint, of course, was less than 50 at week 48, and non-completers were considered failures. About 280 people were included in each arm, and this study, like most that we're doing in the United States, was largely male and largely non-white. About 60% of the individuals were African-American. And more patients in the raltegravir arm made it to 48 weeks in the efavirenz arm. And this is because there were more discontinuations in people who are on efavirenz for a variety of reasons, but often also toxicity. At week 48, 86% on raltegravir compared to 82% on efavirenz had a viral load less than 50. So pretty similar results. But notable is that not only did raltegravir go toe-to-toe with efavirenz, but maybe even had a little bit more on top than efavirenz, not statistically different. This clearly met the condition for non-inferiority. Thus, it could be said that raltegravir was not inferior to efavirenz. CD4 cell count gains were seen in both arms, with a greater increase seen with raltegravir, interestingly enough. when you look at pure virologic failure, so not just, you know, how many people made it to less than 50 because their drug was working and they were still on their drug and tolerating it, when you look just at the virologic failures that emerged on this study, there were 39 with efavirenz versus 27 with raltegravir. And only a fraction, unfortunately, had sufficient virus to be tested for resistance, and it showed what we'd expect, that there was NNRTI resistance in the efavirenz arm and some integrase mutations in those who had received raltegravir. Virologic failure, just to be clear, in the study was having a viral load greater than 50 at the time of stopping your drug, or HIV RNA greater than 50 copies at week 24. It also included virologic rebound, that's if your virus rebounded greater than 50 on two occasions, at least a week apart after you initially had a virologic response. When you look at adverse events, overall there were more adverse events with efavirenz than raltegravir, with CNS toxicity being a big issue for efavirenz, of course, and that's, again, par for the course for that drug. Raltegravir was more lipid-friendly, except for HDL, where efavirenz produced better responses. So that's, again, something we've seen, that with NNRTIs, HDL goes up, and maybe with boosted PIs we see the same thing. Raltegravir doesn't seem to lead to as much of an increase in HDL, but it was much more lipid-neutral when it came to the other lipid subfractions. I think for me, this study provides the much-needed ammunition to use this drug up front for those who are inclined to do so. And I think that there's more and more reasons to think about using raltegravir earlier in therapy. Most boosted PIs don't perform as well as efavirenz when looking at virologic efficacy in these types of clinical trials. And again, raltegravir at least does as well as efavirenz and puts this really on the treatment map. It's still a twice-a-day drug, and it's not yet co-formulated with anything else. So it still, I think, has an uphill climb in terms of competing with the fixed-dose combination of efavirenz, tenofovir, and FTC. But for some people, I think raltegravir is an option, and these data provide backbone for such use. Now, to go to the something old category, and there are a number of different studies that we can talk about. And remember, in HIV, the field considers something old anything that happened more than 6 months ago. So there were updated 96-week data from three head-to-head trials that are worth mentioning. These included data from Artemis, a trial that compared darunavir-ritonavir once a day with lopinavir-ritonavir, the CASTLE study, atazanavir-ritonavir versus, again, lopinavir-ritonavir, and the HEAT trial of tenofovir FTC versus abacavir 3TC. The extended data from Artemis is of interest. This is a study of almost 700 treatment-naive patients. It compared 800-100 of darunavir-ritonavir with standard-issue lopinavir-ritonavir. And in this study, remember, lopinavir-ritonavir could be given either once a day or twice a day. And as I'll mention in a second, most people started out with the older formulation of lopinavir-ritonavir and then ultimately switched. At 48 weeks, we had data before, and these have recently been published in the journal AIDS. There were excellent responses with both drugs when co-administered with tenofovir FTC. Darunavir-ritonavir led to a greater proportion of patients getting to less than 50 at week 48, but this was not inferior to lopinavir-ritonavir. So week 48, darunavir-ritonavir was not non-inferior, but also not superior to lopinavir-ritonavir. Thus, they had very similar responses. What happened at 96 weeks? What we see is that there was a fairly persistent and consistent rate of virologic suppression with darunavir-ritonavir. So there really wasn't much change from week 48 to week 96. On the other hand, when you look at lopinavir-ritonavir, there was a dip in the proportion of people with a less than 50 viral load after week 48, to the degree such that darunavir-ritonavir now does achieve superiority to lopinavir-ritonavir at 96 weeks. The difference between the two, again, seems to be driven by drop-off in the lopinavir-ritonavir arm, and this is driven largely by greater intolerance to lopinavir-ritonavir. More patients discontinued this drug for a variety of reasons, including those not related to virologic failure. In fact, most of the people who discontinued the drug did so not for virologic failure. Although, it should be mentioned, there were more pure virologic failures seen with lopinavir-ritonavir versus darunavir-ritonavir. The difference between lopinavir-ritonavir and darunavir-ritonavir was 17% versus 12%. even when you compare those on BID lopinavir, ritonavir, because remember, you could be on QD or BID, and there could be problems with QD and pharmacokinetics and drug levels with any formulation at that dosing frequency. But when you compare those on BID lopinavir, ritonavir to darunavir, ritonavir, there still was evidence of a significantly lower rate of virologic suppression with the lopinavir, ritonavir. There were some modest differences in lipid seen, mostly in triglycerides favoring darunavir. Again, the formulation of lopinavir, ritonavir may or may not have been an issue. Most people started out with the older formulation, but by the end of the study, 86% had already switched to the Meltrex drug. We'll talk about the implications of this study after also discussing the CASEL results. Similar data were presented from 96 weeks. This is the data cut of the CASEL study, which had already been presented at 48 weeks. This is a study of lopinavir-ritonavir versus atazanavir-ritonavir. At 48 weeks, these drugs, when combined with tenofovir FDC, looked remarkably similar. This is a large study, 800 treatment-naive patients. Not surprisingly, there was a lipid advantage going to atazanavir-ritonavir. At 96 weeks, again, like we saw in Artemis, there's a tapering of the efficacy of lopinavir-ritonavir, whereas atazanavir maintained the efficacy we had seen at 48 weeks. As in Artemis, there's a variety of non-virologic causes of treatment discontinuation. Certainly, GI adverse events were more common with lopinavir-ritonavir, and there were greater increases in triglycerides. But there were other things that were going on at the same time that were nonspecific. Both the Artemis study and CASEL reveal a limitation, I think, of lopinavir-ritonavir when you're comparing it with PIs that are boosted with much less ritonavir. I think what's driving a lot of the inability to continue on lopinavir-ritonavir is the ritonavir. In both studies, we see more patients abandon lopinavir-ritonavir, and usually not for virologic reasons. The GI toxicity provides an explanation, but it's only part of the picture. There's more going on there, and I think it's just not being able to continue to take therapy. For some reason, in CASEL, for example, four times more people on lopinavir-ritonavir withdrew consent than those on atazanavir. So there's something going on there. I think these results probably mean that for those who can stick with lopinavir-ritonavir, they'll probably do fine. A caveat, of course, is that Artemis may argue that, you know, there was a bit more virologic failure among those receiving lopinavir-ritonavir compared to darunavir-ritonavir, and that this was just statistically significant. It's a p-value of 0.044, but it's there. So that could add a little bit of a chink in the armor, saying that these are going to be virologically the same if they're tolerated. But generally, it does seem that for most patients, they'll do virologically well if they can tolerate the drug. But there's problems to longer-term ability to stay on lopinavir-ritonavir compared to some of these other drugs. Clearly, most people do stay on it, so I think you have to balance this. But we can't predict who will do well with the drug prior to exposure, and atazanavir is already giving lopinavir-ritonavir a run for its money, and darunavir is poised to. So I think these will be further ammunition that these competitors to lopinavir-ritonavir will use to indicate that they could provide the same type of virologic efficacy and better tolerability. So what does this all mean? We have two studies here, CASEL and Artemis, that seem to indicate to us that a drug we've had around for a long time, lopinavir-ritonavir, may not work as well as we'd like over the long haul. Well, I think there's some important things to remember. One is that these are both pharmaceutical company-sponsored studies, and hopefully that doesn't make a big difference, but we know, those of us, especially those of us who are cynical, that they have some influence. This is not a non-denominational ACTG trial, for instance. So I think these results have to be viewed through that prism. I think another thing that we have to appreciate is that these were secondary endpoints. The primary endpoint was at 48 weeks. This is a secondary endpoint. Does that mean it's meaningless? No. I think it is important, and I think what we're seeing consistently in both these studies is that there is a challenge for many patients to remain on therapies that are more difficult to take, and I do think that we're seeing lopinavir-ritonavir become relatively more difficult than other drugs, whether it be an efavirenz-based regimen or atazanavir once a day or darunavir once a day, again, with less norovir. So I think these are important data that we can incorporate into our clinical practice when we look at patients who are coming in. Clearly, already we're voting with our prescription pads. Atazanavir sales are up, and because we are prescribing that drug. What will happen with darunavir, ritonavir? Well, now we'll see, now that we have a formulation that actually we can use to craft an 800-100 once-a-day regimen with that drug. So bottom line is we're going to have to take these results into consideration. Patients will generally do well on lopinavir, ritonavir, but over the longer haul, it looks like more of them will have trouble with the drug and have to switch to an alternative. And that may make some of us feel like, well, maybe we should use an alternative to begin with, and others who feel more comfortable with this co-formulated product that we've seen for a long time that we know, we might feel more comfortable taking our chances. And I think that's going to be a very individual decision based upon your clinical practice. I'm going to move now to the HEAT trial. This is a study that has gotten a lot of press in the past. It's comparing abacavir 3TC to tenofovir FTC in patients already taking lopinavir or ritonavir once a day. These are 96-week data, and I really don't have too much to say about the study, just to note that there were 96-week data. I think the good news for the makers of abacavir for this study was that there was no bad news. As was seen previously, both arms have nearly identical efficacy rates. In the poster, what the authors have tried to do is reassure those who have what I call abacavir hyperanxiety syndrome. These are people who are so freaked out over recent results regarding abacavir that they don't know what to do. They're in like apoplexy about what to do with this drug. And that's brought on by recent results from the ACTG 5202 study that found that there was a lower rate of virologic efficacy for abacavir 3TC versus tenofovir FTC in those with a screening viral load greater than 100,000. Not to mention the whole brouhaha regarding DAD and SMART and abacavir and myocardial infarction risk. What we get in this particular HEAT presentation at 96 weeks is an examination of the 48 to 49 people in each arm with virologic failure. And these were fractured into those with high viral load and low viral load at baseline. And there were slightly more people on tenofovir FTC who failed with a baseline viral load less than 100,000. Meaning, of course, that there were more people on abacavir 3TC proportionally who failed with a higher baseline viral load. These are relatively small numbers. I don't know what it means, and I'm not even sure why it was presented. There were slightly more mutations at the 184 locus in the tenofovir-containing arm, 17 versus 11 in the abacavir arm. But again, this is a study of over 680 people. I don't know how much that really means to me. Just as a footnote, there was another study that's related called the Ares study, Ares like the zodiac or the Greek god. This is a single-arm study of 515 people starting HIV therapy who were screened for HLA-B5701 and once found negative were given abacavir 3TC plus atazanavir-ritonavir. The study calls for people to be randomized after 36 weeks to a simplification to unboosted atazanavir. What's presented here is just the 36-week data. And what happened was that before the simplification, already 77% of people had a viral load less than 50 by intent to treat analysis. And that's nice. I think those are very useful data. The investigators played with some subgroup analyses, again, reassuringly and a little bit defensively, given the ACTG 5202 data. And it showed that there was a slight decline in virologic efficacy in those with higher baseline viral loads. That's seen with all the PIs, although notably it's not seen with efavirenz consistently. And that even when the A5202 outcome definitions were used, there was no great change in efficacy. Again, this is a much smaller study. This is a helpful poster in that we have really precious little data on atazanavir, ritonavir in treatment-naive patients, except for CASEL. For those of us who for some reason have to pass on the tenofovir FTC and reach for abacavir 3TC, it's reassuring and helpful to know that there are data short-term, 36-week data, on that particular combination of abacavir 3TC and atazanavir or ritonavir. So we talked about something old and new, and now for something more borrowed or more accurately, something redone, a do-over. So the MERIT study is another one of these comparative head-to-head trials. It looked at maraviroc versus favirans. And going up against a favirans, one has to tremble a little bit because nothing ever beats a favirans. We talked about the raltegravir data, which are pretty impressive considering how well a favirans does in clinical trials. Maraviroc went up against the giant slayer and was mildly disappointing to those of us looking for another drug to use up front in that maraviroc did not seem to do as well against efavirenz as many had hoped. Large study, 740 people were enrolled in MERIT. Powerful study. At 48 weeks, 65% of those on maraviroc had a viral load less than 50, compared to 69% of those on efavirenz. With a study of this size, that is a meaningful difference. Of note, everyone got combivir on this study. So the difference was 4.2% overall, with a confidence interval that just exceeded the outer bounds for non-inferiority. The outer bound was 10%, and the 95% confidence interval for this difference was 10.9%. This means there was enough of a chance that maraviroc was not non-inferior to efavirenz. Again, disappointing results. Subsequently, the investigators have tried to explain this finding by looking at mitigating factors. This is sort of their version of hanging chads. Is there something that we can look at, given the results were so darn close, that can help push it over the edge? Primarily, what they've been doing is looking to see whether or not there were folks who were enrolled in the study who were not really R5 tropic. They did screen using the older Trofile test for R5 virus, and you could only get into the study if you had R5 virus at screening. So what they first tried to do was look at people who were found not to have R5 virus during the study. So they eventually were determined to have dual mixed virus and exclude those. And that did lead to some impact on the results. It didn't completely explain all the virologic failures, however. It did show that there was a better response when those people were eliminated, but it didn't explain every single one of those virologic failures that were reported during the study. In the present analysis, what the investigators have now done is apply the enhanced Trofile test to the screening specimens that were collected during the study. So the enhanced Trofile, this is sort of like the Lexus of Trofile test. It has a 30-fold increase in sensitivity to detect minority variants. So what they did was they took the 721 people who entered the study, looked at their screening results. These are all people who on the old test were found to have R5 virus. Well, lo and behold, when you use the enhanced test, 15% were found to have non-R5 virus at screening, and these were all dual mixed. So what these investigators played with is what happens if you exclude these people from the primary analysis. And when you do so, the numbers change. 68% of those on maraviroc got a viral load less than 50, and 68% of those on efavirenz. So it levels it completely. In fact, there were similar data presented from an ACTG trial of vicraviroc, another R5 inhibitor, that showed a very similar sort of response, that if you exclude people who really, truly aren't R5 tropic, lo and behold, you get a better response when you have an R5 antagonist. But unfortunately, I think you don't get really a second chance to make a first impression. And many have it in their minds that maraviroc is not a contender for first-line status. These results may sway some, but are they going to sway them up and over the barriers to use of this drug? The barriers include need for a screening test, like the Trofile, and its cost. I'm not sure, and I think it's still going to be a challenge for this drug to elbow its way in, given the data that we're seeing from competitor drugs, including newer drugs like raltegravir. A completely different topic, it's not randomized clinical trials, that I think is also worth noting is one of the most important studies that were presented at these conferences, and that was from the NA Accord. This is the North American AIDS Cohort Collaboration on Research and Design study. This is a very ambitious effort to look at data collected over a number of different cohorts and combined to try to determine if there's any difference between starting HIV therapy at a CD4 cell count above 350 but below 500 compared to people who start with a CD4 cell count, as is recommended, at around 350. So there was a lot of press about this, and I think appropriately so, given we really don't have a lot of data that helps us understand when we should initiate therapy. We know that people who start HIV therapy under 200 CD4 cells do not do as well as far as morbidity and mortality as those who start with a CD4 cell count over 200. There are other data that indicate that if you parse it out and look at those who start at 200 to 350, they do a little bit better than people who start at lower CD4 cell counts, but that we don't see a much greater difference or any greater benefit for those who start over 350. So I think it's important for us to get more data, and there is a randomized clinical trial looking at when to start, randomizing people to start at a CD4 cell count of 500 or above or defer therapy. This present analysis that I'm going to discuss tries to emulate that clinical trial setting by looking at different groups who started with a CD4 cell count at 350 or below and those who started with a CD4 cell count that was higher than 350 but less than 500. Just for background, the NA Accord is a collaboration of 22 different cohorts from the United States and Canada. It's prospective and ongoing and collects data on a regular basis that were used to inform this analysis. All the study patients were HIV-infected people with a CD4 cell count of 351 to 500 who were in active follow-up between 1996 and 2006. And all these people went on to get HIV therapy. They were all treatment naive when they were looked at in this analysis. The outcome measure was all-cause mortality. They want to see what happens with mortality specifically when you initiate therapy at once or you defer till the CD4 cell count drops. So the comparator groups that are being looked at are those who started therapy at CD4 cell count 351 to 500 versus those who deferred therapy. They used a number of different sophisticated models to do this and analytical techniques to try to reduce bias. They included thousands of patients. Over 8,000 patients were studied with over 24,000 person years of follow-up. Again, mostly male. In this study, about 40% were white, meaning 60% were non-white. And a good amount, about 20%, had injection drug use, and about a third almost, a quarter to a third, had hepatitis C co-infection. So a pretty representative sample of what we're seeing in our clinics. When you look at the data and look at the two groups and compare mortality, what they found is those who initiate HART initially compared to those who defer HART to CD4 cell count goes below 350 or at 350, what we see is that the hazard ratio for mortality is about 1.7, meaning there's a 70% increased risk of mortality by deferring HIV therapy. These are striking data, and really, I think, are the strongest we have currently that indicates that there may very well be a difference when you look at people with a CD4 cell count 350 to 500 comparing to those who start with a CD4 cell count less than 350. This is a robust data set with a lot of detail and a large number of patients. So I think this is going to be hard to ignore, caveats and all, about how the analyses were done. They did find that there were some other risk factors that might also play into this. Most strong was age, and that makes sense. The older you are, the more likely it was that you'd have mortality in the time frame of follow-up. But HIV therapy deferral was the most significant and the most powerful that was reported. They looked at a number of different things to try to balance and control. They showed that adherence to therapy was pretty much equal among those patients who started with a CD4 cell count that was higher versus those who ultimately started with a CD4 cell count that was lower. They looked at injection drug use and controlled for that. So I think there's a number of analytical techniques that are going into this to try to say, you know, when you look at the group who deferred therapy, accounting for all the things that we can account for, there still is this effect, and we think it's due to delayed therapy. Another significant aspect of this is that in other studies where you look at people who start therapy at the get-go under 350 and start therapy at over 350, there's a risk for lead time bias. That is, for those who you're looking at with a lower CD4 cell count, you're only getting the survivors. You're not getting the people who didn't live long enough to start their HIV therapy. By including people with higher CD4 cell counts and following them with this data set, I think we get a much better picture of the risk of that delay, because now we can count and include those people who actually don't make it to initiate. So if you're only looking at people who initiated a CD4 cell count of 320, well, that excludes all the people who didn't make it to 320 because they had their heart attack or they had their hepatic failure or they had their stroke or even their opportunistic condition like a cancer. So I think this is much more thorough and much more informed than some of the data we've had from other cohort studies. Clearly, though, the bottom line is we're going to need to see the results from a randomized trial as well. Will these results be enough to change practice? I think we have to see more. This is one presentation. I think when it gets into print, that will be very helpful. And there's still some questions I have about how clear we are about confounding variables. There may be things that are very hard to measure that can contribute to morbidity and mortality amongst those who deferred therapy, chaos in your life, insurance status, other things that may have a bearing on whether or not you started HIV therapy, but could also increase your risk for doing poorly even before you do start therapy. So I'm interested in that, and I think that will have to be fleshed out more in this particular study. But overall, I think profound and provocative results from this particular group, and undoubtedly we'll hear more about this topic in the next coming weeks and months. So in summary, I think there were some important data that were presented at this conference. It's hard with so many conferences diluting out some of the data to have home runs at every single one of these conferences. I think the NA Accord data is certainly of that caliber. I think the head-to-head trials that we saw help us understand even more about the potential advantages and liabilities of the therapies we're using. And the raltegravir data are certainly welcome. There's more than enough room for another new drug to come in and be an alternative to the drugs that we're using now. And I think this opens up, again, the options for our patients and ourselves in our clinics.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from the 2008 ICAC IDSA Joint Conference. For more coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/ICAAC2008.